Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in into our podcast today, where we'll be discussing cellular therapy in solid tumors, and in particular, tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and melanoma. My name is Brooke Adams, and I'm a board-certified oncology pharmacist that specializes in stem cell transplant and cellular therapy at the Orlando Health Cancer Institute in Orlando, Florida. And today, I have the distinct pleasure to be joined by other pharmacy experts across the country today, Dr. Natalie Brumwell and Dr. Bryant Clemens. Would you guys like to take some time to introduce yourselves to everyone?
Yeah, thank you so much, Brooke. So like you mentioned, my name is Natalie Brumwell, and I'm a board-certified oncology pharmacist, and I specialize in cellular therapy over at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
My name is Bryant Clemens. I'm a board-certified oncology pharmacist working in hematology, blood and marrow transplant, and cellular therapy, and I work at the University of Kentucky's Markey Cancer Center in Lexington, Kentucky.
Awesome. Thank you both so much. We're just going to dive right in. After decades of research, I feel like we finally had the first commercially available tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte, or TILs. And this was FDA approved on February 16th of last year, being lifileucel. It gained its accelerated approval after its phase 2 open-label non-randomized multi-centered trial, and this was the C-14401 trial. And this included adult patients with good performance statuses, so ECOGs of 0 to 1 that are able to tolerate this therapy that we're going to discuss here shortly, that had unresectable or metastatic melanoma. They had to be previously treated with a PD-1 blocking antibody, and if they were BRAF V600 positive, they also had to receive a BRAF and or MEK inhibitor. Cohorts 2 and 4 of this study were the main efficacy cohorts, being a total of 153 patients. And these patients were enrolled from April of 2017 all the way through December of 2019. The primary endpoint of this study was overall response rate, with key secondary endpoints including duration of response and, of course, our endpoints that we like to see: overall survival, progression-free survival, and safety. These patients had to undergo tissue procurement, of course, to be able to make the TILs product. And lifileucel was successfully manufactured in almost 95% of cases within 22 days. After the manufacturing process was completed and we knew cells were on their way and have arrived on site, they underwent high-dose lymphodepletion. And oh my goodness, when we mean high dose, we mean high dose. Cyclophosphamide 60 milligrams per kilo for 2 consecutive days. So we're talking about transplant, like Bu-Cy doses of cyclophosphamide to help prepare that tumor microenvironment. These patients then received their lifileucel with pre-medications that excluded corticosteroids. So they got acetaminophen and diphenhydramine. And they then were receiving high-dose IL-2 starting 3 to 24 hours after lifileucel for up to 6 total doses. So Bryant, how do you feel like the efficacy of lifileucel in this setting compares to previous therapies that we've had in the space?
Yeah, so I'll start by sort of reviewing those reported efficacy outcomes from the initial 2022 publication from Chesney and colleagues. So as Brooke mentioned, the two main efficacy cohorts included a total of 153 patients. And in these patients, they saw an overall response rate of 31.4%, with 17% or essentially 1/6 of those responses being complete responses. The median duration of response wasn't reached at a median follow-up of 27.6 months. And finally, they reported a median overall survival of 13.9 months and progression-free survival of 4.1 months. So given that this is a phase 2 study, to fully appreciate the significance of these results, we also need to consider other available options and historical outcomes with these therapies. And short outcomes for patients with metastatic melanoma after checkpoint inhibitors and BRAF and MEK inhibitors in eligible patients have not been good. In the absence of a clinical trial, the standard of care has not been firmly established. There was a multi-center retrospective analysis published in 2022 looking at the benefits of cytotoxic chemotherapy in these patients after they had failed checkpoint inhibitors. And there was a lot of variety in those chemo agents that were used, but in total, they saw an overall response rate of about 12% and an overall survival rate of 7.1 months from the start of chemotherapy. So given the lack of efficacy of cytotoxic chemotherapy, another strategy that's used is to try and reuse checkpoint inhibitors. So often using ipilimumab alone or in combination with anti-PD-1 agents, or perhaps nivolumab or latlimab combo, depending on what was used in the frontline setting. And here you do tend to get higher rates of response than we see with cytotoxic chemotherapy in this setting, ranging anywhere from 10 to 30%. But still nothing like we're seeing when these are used in the frontline setting. Duration of responses are highly variable and still leave a lot to be desired. So really nothing pre-lifileucel promising. Beyond these options, there's considerations for like a molecular tumor board to try and identify additional targetable mutations and things like that. But these are generally very rare in melanoma, and outcomes aren't well reported to the extent that we feel comfortable as these as like a trustworthy option or anything like that in these patients. So to tie it back to those efficacy results, the efficacy outcomes that we're seeing with lifileucel are exciting and make it pretty clear as to why it's why it received its FDA approval last year.
Awesome, Brian. Thank you so much for giving us that perspective. Natalie, what do you think about these patterns of response? Do you feel like there are some patients that get more bang for their buck per se compared to others when they're getting lifileucel?
Yeah, so looking even further out, there was a four-year analysis of the C-14-01 trial by Medina and colleagues. They published this looking at the long-term efficacy as well as patterns of response with lifileucel. And it was really interesting to see that patients continue to respond even if they didn't have a strong initial response at their day 42 visit. So we saw a deepened response over time, which is really promising to see for these patients, with patients even moving from stable disease to a partial response to CR or complete response on their follow-up visits. Also, it was really interesting to see that overall, the four-year overall survival rates were looking at 47%. So that's a really big improvement compared to our metastatic melanoma patients prior to lifileucel.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that, Natalie. Of course, when we think about therapies and we're thinking about these whopping doses of cyclophosphamide and IL-2, there, of course, are going to be risks and non-relapse mortality that we have to discuss. These patients have to be candidates for this therapy. They have to be able to withstand these lymphodepletion doses that are really like transplant doses and everything that comes with high-dose IL-2. So if you weren't in the era of high-dose IL-2 a couple decades ago, it has made its way back. And even though it is not directly therapeutic for TILs, it works to support that post-infusion T-cell activity. So patients should not be necessarily offered TILs unless they can be deemed suitable candidates for IL-2. Brian, what do you feel are the most notable adverse events that we've seen with high-dose IL-2? And were these patients able to tolerate it?
Yeah, I think TILs are not for the faint of heart or the faint of lungs or renal function or any other sort of vital organ. I think it's fair to call it a highly toxic treatment regimen in total, especially considering the IL-2 considerations. I'll sort of briefly go through the adverse events that were reported for the general patients, but then really hone in on those IL-2 toxicities. So 30% or more than 30% of their patients experienced at least one grade 3 or 4 adverse event. Probably not surprisingly, given the lymphodepletion, most of these tend to be cytopenias. So those are fairly manageable, just like they are in patients receiving standard care transplant and other chemotherapy agents. But when you look specifically at side effects that are likely a result of the IL-2, so even just common things like chills, 75% of patients are experiencing chills, 51.9% or having a fever. The majority of those are going to be classified as neutropenic fever, again, because of the aforementioned cytopenias. Hypotension, 33%, any grade hypotension, with 11% being grade 3 or 4 hypotension. And so one factor to consider is, are you giving this just sort of on a standard progressive care floor, or some centers may decide that they prefer to give it in an ICU because of that risk of hypotension and other organ compromise. When it comes to rare but serious side effects, so they did report one patient who had ICANS and CRS, sort of overlapping a little bit with like CAR T toxicities. It is worth mentioning this was solely based off of investigator assessment. They didn't draw cytokine levels or anything like that to confirm. But 7 of the 153 patients experienced capillary leak syndrome, which can obviously be very severe. So rare, but a lot of different things that can go wrong with these patients. Worth mentioning, just from a general standpoint, the 5-year analysis that was published this year, they reported that in those 153 patients studied, there were 12 deaths attributed to investigator-reported adverse events, with 4 of these patients passing away within 30 days of their TIL infusion. So again, very important to be making sure that patients are sort of suitable candidates for these, given the degree of toxicity that comes with it. There's sort of a silver lining, I think, of the adverse effect profiles that once patients have gotten through their IL-2 course and have recovered from that, most patients tend to recover well, though it's worth noting there was at least one death sort of beyond that 30-day post TIL infusion window that was attributed to bone marrow failure. So rare, but another thing to keep in mind. And then finally, so when we think about these toxicities, especially the IL-2, it bears pointing out that while the regimen does call for up to 6 doses of IL-2, sort of following TIL administration, it is not required that patients necessarily receive all of these doses. So interestingly, when you look at this study, I would say that they were generally fairly aggressive with their IL-2 administration. Their median number of doses is actually that full number of doses, the 6 doses. So they did a post hoc analysis and sort of broke them down into different groups. So 16 of those patients received only 1 or 2 doses. 26 patients received 3 or 4 doses. And then again, the majority, 109 patients, received either 5 or 6 doses. But as we'll discuss, this fairly aggressive strategy may or may not necessarily lead to sort of improved efficacy.
That's a great transition, Brian. Thank you for bringing that up. So we always thought we need to push the dose of IL-2. We need to support those T cells and the flourishment of TILs. But there's been some retrospective analyses that have been done that says in patients that may not be able to even receive IL-2 at all, the overall response rate was almost 30% in the 17 patients, suggesting that there still is this efficacy of TILs despite the lack of high IL-2. There also has been no clear correlation observed between the total number of doses of IL-2 and response, reinforcing the importance that I think of delaying or discontinuing therapy promptly upon toxicity. Now, Natalie, at your institution, how important is it that they receive all of these 6 doses of IL-2 even when they begin to experience toxicity? How do you guys decide when to stop, when to delay, or when to call it altogether? And what has been your role as a clinical pharmacy specialist dealing with these TILs patients on the daily?
Thanks, Brooke. This is a really important talking point and a very important area for pharmacists to help manage. So I would agree, there's no clear correlation between number of IL-2 doses and response. Our general approach is that giving one dose of IL-2 is better than none to provide some of that activation of cells, but it's not worth it to increase the risk for irreversible toxicity by pushing for more of those doses. So at our institution, we have set guideline criteria that we use to decide when we want to delay versus entirely stop doses for patients. And it's really important that as a team, prior to every IL-2 dose, we discuss clearing these patients prior to giving them anything. So we make sure that we look through our guidelines and talk through and making sure that they're meeting all the criteria to continue to proceed with their doses. So that being said, we think about, you know, what type of issues are we looking out for? When there are things that are more like irreversible issues, so we're thinking, you know, end organ dysfunction, signs of renal toxicity, cardiac issues, we see their serum creatinine rising above a certain threshold, we see their urine output dropping. These are all typically hard stops for us at this point. when we think about more of our reversible issues, like maybe some GI upset, patients having fevers, rigors, these are all things that we can typically manage as a team by using supportive care, utilizing different medications. And this is really how we decide moving forward, whether we're going to push forward with more doses or not. You know, there's some patients where what's been a rough start, just getting through the chemo and the TILs, how will they do with their IL-2? And, you know, they magically make it through all six doses. We have other patients where things are all smooth sailing. They get that first dose of IL-2 and it really rocks them hard, especially when it hits their kidneys. So you really have to take it patient by patient, keep a very close eye on their labs, their symptoms, and decide from there as a team before dosing. And as a pharmacist on the team, I would say definitely a big role in helping manage these toxicities. You know, like we talked about before, patients having chills and rigors. Rigors are definitely one of those scary symptoms for patients. So as a pharmacist, I was involved with helping transition our patients over to IV morphine to help with rigors as needed, just in the setting of the meperidine shortage. We have all of our IL-2 pre-meds actually built into our treatment plans, which is really great, but we can always optimize things further as needed, you know, based on how patients are doing, such as, you know, optimizing their nausea medications. And then even helping with managing, you know, if patients are having any reactions at the bedside, that's another role we have too. So there's really a lot of room for pharmacists to be involved with this.
Thank you so much for that, Natalie. And I agree with all that you said. Now, before this discussion today, Natalie and I had been talking offline about how we do things differently at our two institutions. So we schedule it every 8 hours, but we have hold parameters on when to give the high dose IL-2 or the next dose. But Natalie, I don't think you schedule it every 8 hours, right?
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Brooke. So at my institution, we do the Q12 hour dosing. So we aim for about every 12 hours. We try to utilize the 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. schedule, you know, plus or minus a few hours, depending on how our patients are doing. But we typically will utilize this time frame just because we find it's a little bit easier as a team to provide clearance. But it does make sense how you mentioned that every 8 hours with hold parameters, because we do have that flexibility in terms of IL-2 dosing.
Perfect. I think this goes to show that there's more than one right way to do a high dose IL-2 at your institution, depending on if you have nighttime coverage or not.
Definitely.
And because this therapy is so specialized, there's only select sites that are really doing it and very limited non-academic sites. I technically work at a large community hospital that's not academic, and we're one of the few in the nation that's offering this. So what does the referral process look like at your cancer center, Natalie? And when do these patients commonly get to go back to their local providers?
Yeah, that's definitely a great point, thinking about the differences between different types of centers. At my institution, our patients are referred over to our cell therapy melanoma physicians. So they're the ones who see our patients for their screening, as well as prior to admission, and help with the whole process of getting their surgical harvest set up. In terms of sending patients back to their primary team, so to give you kind of a general overview of our workflow, a lot of our patients actually receive their high-dose lymphodepletion on the outpatient setting and will utilize Mesna CAD pumps with the high-dose Cytoxan or cyclophosphamide. And then the inpatient team is the group that helps manage our TIL infusion or lifileucel infusion, as well as the subsequent IL-2 doses. After that, we loop back in our CTS melanoma physicians, and they typically go back over to their provider around the day 28 mark with plans to do their follow-up restaging at day 42.
Awesome. Thank you, Natalie. And you guys are an institution that have been doing TILs even in clinical trials. But for a site that may not have been involved in the TILs clinical trials, like Brian at the University of Kentucky, can you tell us what this is going to look like for the onboarding of TILs, and what do you envision your process and your service line looking like for these patients?
Yeah, here at UK, we're in a bit of a limbo state right now where we've Recently sort of completed our onboarding and have everything in place, but haven't treated a patient just yet. It's looking like that could change in the near future. But having recently gone through this onboarding process, I can say it's certainly going to be very individualized depending on the center. As you all have already alluded to, every center is going to vary in terms of the resources that they have, available team makeups, overnight coverage, things like that. I think one important consideration is to iron out as much as possible that referral process that Natalie was alluding to for her center. It's so important, especially if there's a separation between the medical oncologist initially seeing the patient and deeming them a potential candidate for TILs and the cellular therapy team, who's going to ultimately sort of make that determination. And that's the setup that we have at my institution. And, you know, there's already sort of that built-in lag time based on cell harvesting and manufacturing, delivery back to the treatment center. And so minimizing as much as we can any further delays between referrals from medical oncology to cell therapy and cell therapy to the surgeon team, a pre-admit visit prior to their starting lymphodepletion, all these things, the more that we can cut down on the time that's going between these things, and the more effective we're going to be at getting these patients treated in a timely manner. And then once starting treatment, again, it's probably going to need to be done on an inpatient basis. Natalie alluded to maybe some outpatient conditioning, depending on your ability to provide sort of Mesna in that setting. But when it comes time to the cell infusion, and especially the IL-2, inpatient's really going to be the only option there. So at UK, for example, we'll be treating them on our BMT and cell therapy service. Every center, again, going to be very individualized based off of the resources that they have available. But there's a lot of considerations to take into account whenever you're sort of developing your process. So to just name a couple of these examples, again, you all have already talked about the timing of IL-2. Do you do it every 8 hours, every 12 hours? Do you start it in the evening after their cell infusion, or do you wait until the next day? All of these things are important. For example, on our end, we've decided more towards that like every 12 hour, just giving it twice a day regimen starting the next day after. And another thing that we've done is timing out the entire regimen. So from the start of lymphodepletion to TIL infusion, so that we're only giving TILs on either a Monday or a Tuesday. And that way that leaves IL-2 to be given on Tuesday through Friday. And we're not having to worry about it being done over the weekend because we have a bit more of a skeleton crew from a clinical coverage side on the weekends. So that's one consideration. I think another consideration would be to specify timing of the evaluation for that next IL-2 dose. So Natalie mentioned trying to make sure that all the key stakeholders are involved and able to be present, whether it's bedside or close at hand, to be able to determine if they're eligible. And then once you get that determination that you are going to proceed with the IL-2 dose, communicating that, and ideally not sort of compounding or mixing the drug until you get that determination, because the IL-2 is a very expensive product. So trying to minimize as much as you can waste where you prepare a dose, but then a patient doesn't end up being a candidate for any further IL-2 dosing. If you can minimize that waste, that's going to be very important from a center perspective. The last thing I'll say from the onboarding perspective is that as centers are developing their processes, you know, Iovance, the manufacturer of Lafilicel, is pretty hands-on and active and available to sort of be involved in helping provide perspective on what other similar centers are doing, maybe even putting you into contact with centers if you don't know people to reach out to proactively. So while it sounds like a lot to sort of take on and work through, there is support that can be leveraged in trying to figure out the best way to provide this and similar therapies at your treatment center.
Natalie and Brian, those are amazing pro tips. Thank you for sharing those with our listeners and having such a great discussion today. I will say it's truly an exciting time for cellular therapy and solid tumors, and what's likely only the beginning. As we conclude today's session, do you both have any final remarks for our listeners? Natalie, we'll start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Brooke. It's been so great talking with you all today. I love to see how different centers are operationalizing Lifilucel, and it's really exciting just to see the growth of cellular therapy. I think there's definitely a lot of room for pharmacy involvement and management with these products. And it's also really helpful for institutions like ours to talk to each other about our experiences, management, working on guidelines, and just looking for ways that we can help increase access for our patients.
And what do you think, Brian? What are some final remarks for our listeners today?
Yeah, I echo everything Natalie said. I try to think of it both locally and globally. You know, locally, you want the patients in your region and your referral networks to have access to these therapies when they need them. But then globally, you know, we're all working toward the same goal, which is increased quality of care and outcomes for the patients that we're treating. So the more that we can do as individual treatment centers to make these complex therapies available, whether it be something standard of care like we're talking about today, or especially like a novel clinical trial, the farther we can sort of all together progress toward that goal. And I think another thing worth pointing out is just this interface between what's traditionally cellular therapy mostly existing in the hematologic sphere and now sort of burgeoning out into the solid tumor sphere and even the non-oncologic sphere as well. Thinking of CAR T for autoimmune disorders that's starting to show some promising preliminary data. So I think the two keys to executing this are, just as Natalie mentioned, open lines of communication across institutions to share expertise, as well as an individual treatment center standpoint, strengthening relationships between these different departments, between cellular therapy and or hematology, medical oncology, again, thinking towards the future, neurology and immunology. So the more that we can sort of build these relationships, sort of develop these referral networks that are efficient and everything, I think we can make sure that our growth and comfort with taking care of these patients and these therapies sort of keeps up with the treatment options that are available to them.
Beautifully said, you both. Thank you both for tuning in today and joining me for this exciting time in cellular therapy and solid tumors. And thank you for our listeners.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant, offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.